Welcome back to Beat Seeker. I'm your host, Matt McButter. In each episode, we explore the shifting world of music with world-renowned experts and artists to take you deep, deep inside the fascinating and changing world of music technology and music discovery.
And I'm your host, Mike Weider, reminding you to subscribe in Apple Podcasts and give us a five-star rating if you like the episode. You can visit our website at beatseeker.fm, where you'll find plenty of rabbit holes with extra content to dive into, guest backgrounds, and even a playlist with music recommendations from each of our guest episodes. Also, BeatSeeker swag. You can stay current and talk to us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at BeatSeekerPod. Nashville, Seattle, New Orleans. These are just a few examples of cities that have organically developed over the years to become incredible music scenes. But in fact, any city can encourage their local music scene so that residents can benefit culturally, economically, and in a host of other ways. Today, we speak with Shane Shapiro, who helps cities understand these benefits and create the right policies to enable them.
Shane is the founder of Sound Diplomacy and a globally recognized thought leader at the convergence of music, culture, and urban policy. He's influenced over 100 cities and places to invest in music and culture as part of their overall growth strategy. He's also the co-founder of Music Cities Convention, bringing together the music industry with city planners, developers, policymakers, and executives. His debut book, This Must Be the Place, How Music Can Make Your City Better, is due out on Repeater Books in September 2023. We reached him in London, England. Shane, thanks so much for joining us on BeatSeeker.
Thanks for having me. What a privilege.
Shane, I know cities have planners that make an official urban plan for their cities that might provide, you know, vision for future growth and maybe a policy framework to guide physical development, taking into account all kinds of things like traffic and bike lanes, industrial areas, sewers, you know, all those kind of supports and services. But in a recent TED Talk that I saw, you stated that all cities should also have a music plan and strategy in place. Can you explain to our listeners, what is a music strategy and why do cities need one?
Music is something that touches all of us, right? Music is our universal language. Yet music is something that we don't really think about strategically. You know, we don't really think about, well, why is that music venue over there? Or, do we cater in our music education policy to all genres and all disciplines? And in doing so, kind of, you know, meet and respect the demography of the community. And, you know, so a music strategy can manifest itself in a bunch of different ways. But the whole reason is to just get more out of music, as we say. And in order to do that, you need to understand where it is. You need to measure its value economically and socially. You need to compare it and understand its role against other policies, because music is something that is governed by other policies, from alcohol and liquor to urban planning, as you discussed, to education. And music is either a net beneficiary or negatively impacted by things that it has nothing to do with. So when we work with cities to help them develop music policies, we say, well, let's put music front and center. It's not solely about growing the music industry or commercial music industry. That's a part of it. It's really about understanding the role that music plays holistically in a community and how to build, literally and figuratively, a community that understands, respects, evaluates, measures, and celebrates music and do it in an intentional way.
So how much does music drive economics for cities? I mean, do you have some numbers you can give us? Is that,
the U.S., the U.S. average, Canada's probably very similar, but the U.S. average in a city is between 1.3 and 1.5% of the economy. That is direct music value. That's music jobs, entertainment, nighttime economy related to music and things like that. But, you know, I wonder how many people are going to the gym and then exercising silently. I wonder how many adverts on television have no music.
And how big is that, versus other cultural drivers? For example, sports. Is music bigger than sports? Do you know? I mean,
Sports is bigger than music, but music is bigger than most other art forms. Film is usually a little bigger, depending on the city. Mm-hmm. But, it's similar to, you know, the value of large-scale museums, of other performing arts, theater, and things like that. But I'm not really, you know, we don't really say invest in music and don't invest in art and theater. That's not what we say. We want music to be part of a of a complete rethinking of what matters to us and how we invest in ourselves and our communities. Because mm-hmm. the whole point of a music strategy is to think about investing, you know, in what's in our minds and digging out more of what's in our minds rather than what's in the ground. And really thinking as the creative economy and the music economy can be a non-extractive, genuinely sustainable in the academic definition of the word economy in cities. But it's not taken deliberately. It's not taken intentionally. And in many, many places, it's not taken seriously, genuinely seriously, with the same due diligence that other sectors would receive in terms of just measuring its economic value, good or bad. And so that's what we do is we're kind of on a crusade, not just music, but music and culture and performing arts and other things, but music is at the heart of it, you know, to ensure that communities are taking it seriously. And in order to take it seriously, you need to build a framework to measure that seriousness and do it in a way that's agnostic in every sense of the word.
So what? So you, one of the things your firm will do is it will measure, you know, the economic impact of music in a particular city. And I also understand it. You will help cities then develop a music and cultural plan. Can you explain how that works? Like, how would you engage with a city? Who is involved? How does it come together?
Every city is different, but yeah, a music strategy is kind of three or four component parts. One is what you said, it's the economic impact assessment, like any other sector of music. We need to know what the kinds of jobs are and where they are and how much they're worth and so on. There's also an inventorying or asset mapping, literally mapping everything on a map and comparing it against how we map other things like demography, health, income, crime, lots of things. And you can get pretty granular, like we can map music teachers and choirs and all sorts of things. And then there's a regulatory side of it, the policy side of it, where you look and dig into how the city manages itself from a policy and regulatory perspective. And usually there's stuff in there that is often unintentionally, sometimes intentionally, anti-music, whether that's things related to sound and noise or you know, old issues in communities related to systemic and structural racism. And the strategy comes out of that. So once you kind of know where everything is, how much it's worth, how it fits together, you talk to people, ask them what they want, because that's the most important thing. Then the strategy is kind of a set of specific things that a city or city agencies can do. So in order for a music strategy to be successful, genuinely, you have to build a consortium approach in the city. First off, you need musicians and the music economy to want it, because without them, there's no point in doing anything. And then what we say, you have to build a consortium of kind of non-music people to see the value of music. And that's tourism, economic development, chambers, downtown associations, business improvement districts, things like that, and the city itself, foundations. So you need to try to convince every single organization, and this takes time, that there's a reason for them to care about music. And in doing so, you can elevate the music economy more by getting non-music actors to recognize it, invest in it in their own way, and engage with it more.
So when you think of like the top cities in the world for music, you know, some obvious ones come to mind, like, I don't know, New York or Nashville. But as an expert in this topic, like, what are your thoughts like on which are the best cities for music?
Well, there's different, you know, I love, I kind of hate all the grades of saying this is the best city for live music and this is the best for that. And it's all frankly nonsense. You know, and it tends to come from a racialized perspective, usually a bunch of white people saying this is the best thing for music. And, you know, so I tend to look at it in things that you can judge, and you can judge things based on the policies that are enacted, the measurements that are being undertaken, and the budgets that are being assigned to music and communities. So obviously Austin has been doing it for a very, very long time. They have a very active, engaged music office. Nashville as well, but in a very different way. Nashville's actually, they haven't had a music office for several years. They have one and then it stopped, but they are bringing it back. Our biggest success is Huntsville, Alabama, which has been the most engaged and most active, one of the most engaged and most active cities that we've worked with. They have a full-time music officer now, city-funded, city job. There's a music board. There's new infrastructure, including an amphitheater that just opened last year. New labels, new studios, Women in Music Festival just launched, all sorts of things. But also like in Indianapolis, Indiana, I know these are all American examples. They just changed their all ages ordinance to allow for all ages concerts to happen. And then across Europe and the UK, there's loads and loads of cities that have music offices and have had music offices for a long time. Every province in France and every province in Australia has one. And has had one for a long time. And they're all, you know, they all do amazing work and some of them struggle. You know, New York has one, like, but I can't say, like, I can't compare New York to Huntsville, to Aarhus in Denmark, to, you know, to Perth in Australia. Like, Aarhus is making decisions that make sense for Aarhus, which is a small city in Denmark. You know, so
there's some cities like a New York, whatever, you're just going to expect it's huge. They're going to have a lot of stuff going on with music and other cultural things. But there are cities like you mentioned, like in Austin, for example, that kind of punch above their weight. I haven't been to Huntsville, but, you know, what are those cities doing that's allowed them to be better, you know, given their size? It's really an investment and focus. They have a music officer. You know, what are the other things they're doing to really...
Money, honest recognition and policy.
Yeah. So
they're investing money into the community in one way or another. They are changing policies to make them pro music, whether that's creating street performance ordinances that are better for street performers or buskers, to better live music noise ordinances, to changing their building codes so you can't have, you know, poorly built apartments next to existing music venues, to incorporating music as strategic economic areas in their attracting companies strategies and tourism strategies. And that's the kinds of things that they are doing. Lots and lots of communities are doing bits and bobs. Lots of Canadian communities have done music strategies as well. We've done quite a few of them. And, you know, Canada's a bit different because cities have a lower tax base. They have less genuine kind of room to maneuver in terms of what they can and can't invest in. But there has been a lot of work being done to kind of create these, you know, music cities, music policy, you know, strategies in Canada, and most Canadian cities have done it that I know of.
So you're saying that most, I was going to ask you that, like, how common is this that a city would have a music policy or strategy? And so you're suggesting that most would.
In Canada, I'd say in terms of, let's say cities over 200,000 people.
Yeah.
I'd say half probably.
Okay.
Maybe a little less than half have probably looked at this.
Hmm. Right.
Kingston is doing one now.
Okay.
And Niagara Falls is doing one. And Kelowna just did one, I think. So Calgary and Edmonton we did last year. Lots.
And once cities start to do this, to develop a formal plan and strategy, is there a very clear change that you sort of see happening, that it's probably takes a while for those investments to manifest, but what are the examples you've seen where this is really manifested in a better music scene, either economically or through other attributes?
Yeah, well, you know, I think the question of is this a better music scene is always down to the people in the music scene.
Sure. Like, yeah.
I'm doing my best, but I get that our work is in some ways quite macro work. So it takes time to trickle down and pick up. We're proud of our work in Vancouver. We did a music strategy. The city didn't actually pay for it. It was paid for by others. But the city then subsequently took the recommendations and invested in a music officer position, which still exists. They've done a lot of work to protect music studios and invest in property tax rebates. Again, property tax rebates means less tax to the city. Toronto as well has done a lot of work in terms of trying to understand and support music venues. Toronto has a music committee, which is run by a really intelligent guy. And, and so lots has been done. Hamilton, the street performance ordinance has been amended, making it much easier for buskers to to perform legally and to make more money doing it. So, you know, a lot of this stuff, it's, you know, there's different levels. Recognition of music is this thing that trickles into all sorts of policies that we don't see. Cities write 10, 20 year strategies all the time and write these visions all the time. And all of them say they want a thriving, livable, sustainable city in one way or another.
Yeah.
I have counted one or two in my life that have included music in that. Hmm. So like we, you know, but saying that, we've seen this incredible development, and you know, I've been doing sound diplomacy for 10 years, and I can't claim to have created this stuff. Other people were doing it too, but I've been, you know, at the coal face or whatever it is for quite a long time. And we are seeing loads and loads of stuff that may not reach, you know, the grassroots musician, but that make a huge difference. Like music being a priority economic area for a chamber of commerce. That's happened a lot. That happened in Sault Ste. Marie, of all places. And in Canada, to music being treated seriously in tourism, to cities actually, in the state of California, the governor just signed a bill which allows music venues for the first time to not have to serve food. That was a significant lobbying effort by lots and lots of people. We worked on the music strategy in San Francisco, which fed into this. And, you know, music venues being forced to serve food means that they have to turn themselves into restaurants, and kitchens are expensive to maintain. Mm-hmm. It's a stupid old law that, you know, that was on the books for a long time.
There's all these little friction points that would cause that would slow down the ability for venues or musicians to thrive in a given city. And it's about sort of peeling back some of that stuff. And in other cases, adding things that would help them be more successful.
And also education, like, you know, we've worked on creating music programs in the senior care facilities and ensuring that music education in one way or another is protected in city or regional budgets. You know, so it factors in. It's and also we're doing a lot of educating, again, stuff you don't see, but most people have no idea how music works. Like, you know, the average person is a music listener, turns on the radio, maybe puts Spotify on, goes to a few gigs, how music actually works. And the types of jobs in our business now are very complicated, you know, and the opportunity to me is incredible for communities that recognize the modern music industry and the modern jobs that are in our business, rather than just, you know, person with guitar on stage. But you know, the vast majority of people listen to music passively, not actively. So there's a lot of education we need to do to really reintroduce our sector as a growth sector, and introduce it as something that is non-extractive, that can be done in a way that doesn't harm the planet, that can be done in a way that includes everybody, and can be done locally. And I feel that its investment in local music ecosystems is a great opportunity for communities to, you know, to grow the roots from within, as much as, you know, attract companies from outside.
So I want to look into the future a little bit, or ask you to look into the future. You know, technology is, you know, disrupts every industry and it's been highly disruptive to the music industry. You know, the COVID over the last couple of years has really accelerated the movement to more and more, you know, online streamed events. So when you look into the future, what are some of the changes that you see coming, or things that cities are doing, you know, or could do in the future that might change the landscape of music in our cities?
Certainly the democratization, I don't mean that so much politically, but the democratization of space and the, you know, consistent mixing of uses. I think for cities to compete, you know, the way that we designed cities before COVID is not the way we can design cities now. You know, this whole concept of districts, to me are very valuable, but they need to be mixed use. We can't just have a business district and an entertainment district and housing district, because people work and live and play everywhere. Mm-hmm. So the provision of space for music and how that's coordinated, i.e. how literally how places are built, to how we design revenue models around them, I think that's a great opportunity for the future. So cities potentially looking to invest in music rights. Again, teachers' pension funds and large-scale pension funds have been investing in catalog rights for a long time, but we're investing in stuff that already exists. Couldn't we be investing in future rights by cities and public sector pension funds or private sector pension funds investing in music like they invest in buildings and roads and hospitals? And
interesting.
You do that by having a fund that invests in 20,000, I don't know, X amount of artists in a local community.
Is anyone doing this today that you...
We're working on it.
Okay.
But like there are private sector pension funds that are invested in music rights, many of them.
Sure.
Teachers pension funds as well. But the idea is that you invest in, 99% may not be successful, but 1% may be very successful.
Right.
and the return. But if you tie that to traditional forms of investment in real estate, commercial real estate, I think that there's incredible opportunities there. I think that there's also opportunities in Web3, maybe not in the way that we talk about it as much, in a very kind of binary way. It's either NFTs or nothing. And I think that's kind of ridiculous, is the capacity of Web3 to create transparency in our business is, to me, an opportunity to explain the business in a more simple way to non-music people. So the biggest challenge for the future that I see is are we going to take music seriously as a society or not? And by that, I mean, are we actually going to invest in it holistically, or are we just going to leave it to the market? And there are winners and losers there. If we take music seriously, then we see that it has economic, social, and cultural value, and that requires social and economic and cultural investment. And that is a long-term thing. The perfect example, is a public park. We're all paying for public parks, and yet we seem to be okay with it because we value in a public park. It's for all of us. We all can go to the park. To me, access, creation, ability to engage with music. I'm not saying profit off of it, but the ability to engage with music is a basic right. And if we thought about music more the way we think about public parks or the way we think about access to clean water, something that we all...
That's true. Although, I would think of a park as being the responsibility of my city. Whereas, before talking to you, I would have assumed that the music scene was the private sector and whatever they were doing to sort of make all that happen. But it wasn't necessarily my local municipality that had any part in that role.
We're talking about two different things. So you're talking about the local music scene from a, I would argue, more commercial perspective. If we outline it to the music ecosystem, when we look at music, from nursery to nursing home, access to music, access to instruments at libraries. I'm not saying that everyone should make money out of it because that's never going to happen. I'm hoping more people make money out of it, but I think that music could just play a much more prominent role in everything from, welcoming and integrating immigrants and refugees to, to interfaith dialogue, to frankly making us smarter and more humane individuals, right? Because music is an incredible tool to not only improve cognition, but again, if you're in a big band and you're a kid, you have to learn, it's like being in the army. You have to learn to work with people. You have to learn to play a role. If you screw up, you make other people screw up, or like a sports team. And if we cut that, if we don't kind of codify that into how we think about investing in ourselves and investing in what we all share, which is place, literal land, air, and water, and each other, then we're missing opportunities. So, I think growing the music industry is in as equitable way as possible is integral to that, but that's not the only objective here. Like I don't expect every kid who picks up a violin to become a superstar, but I want a violin to be of access to every kid, whatever instrument or turntables and it's just not. Where you live, what you look like, impacts your ability to access music. And that is wrong. And that is what we're trying to change.
Right. And I guess you're right in that if you look at it from a sporting standpoint, cities invest in sports, in arenas, and facilities, and what have you. And that happens all the time. But you don't really think of music in the same way. And what your argument is that we should be, is that it's good for quality of life, mental health, other attributes beyond the sort of economic value it produces.
Yeah, I wrote an article about the Faroe Islands, which is a place I've been a couple of times, and we have a project there in one of my roles. The Faroe Islands has 50,000 people or some odd, and every single village has a pristine football pitch, soccer pitch, like world-class pristine. Soccer pitch. I went to this place, I think it was called Nolsoy, population 200, incredible football pitch. And they use it for all sorts of things because they recognize, because the Faroese country is obsessed with football, soccer, they are. And so I'm like, well, you know, what if we treated music more like sports? Then we could think about better ways to incorporate it into our communities. But we can't just create new paths to do that. We have to use the paths that already exist. So that's why I'm talking about how we need to integrate music policy into urban planning, into land use policy, into education, into racial justice and equity, all that kind of stuff. We don't have to sit and say, music is the solution to every problem, because it's not. But being incorporated into everything, I think, is a net benefit for everyone. And that's a different way of thinking than my music needs to be successful in my industry for my reasons. And I'm saying that we need to kind of think that the external value of music, growing that, will benefit the internal value of music and vice versa.
Well, we're agreed on that, Shane. And this is the time in the podcast when I'm going to ask you for a music recommendation. So, something we can add to our guest picks playlist. What's something you're into lately?
I've been obsessed with the Drive-By Truckers lately.
Nice.
So, I actually didn't like them for a long time. I thought, I don't know why, but I've just become completely obsessed with their storytelling and their sheer brilliance. And there's an old song on one of their old albums called Outfit. It's all a right. Jason Isbell song, so he sings it.
We're going to put that on. I'm a fan. Great pick. So lastly, if our listeners want to follow your work, where do you want them to go?
Yeah, I have kind of two hats, and I want to share one thing. So I'm the founder of Sound Diplomacy, so sounddiplomacy.com. I'm also the founder, executive director of this new nonprofit, the Center for Music Ecosystems, centerformusicecosystems.com. I'm on social media and Shane Shapiro, and I have a book coming out next year on Repeater Books called This Must Be the Place, How Music Can Make Your City Better. It'll be available on Amazon and all bookshops and stuff, but it'll be available for pre-order in February, and it's out next September. So I'm hoping that, you know, people will hopefully pre-order the book.
Awesome.
Fantastic. Well, we'll put some links to those in the show notes. And Shane, want to thank you so much for being on Beat Seeker today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Shane.
You've been listening to Beat Seeker with your hosts, Matt McButter and Mike Wider. If you like the show, go to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts and hit the subscribe button. While you're there, leave us a rating and a comment and share it with your friends and colleagues. If you want to dig deeper into this content, visit beatseeker.fm. That's beatseeker.fm. Interact with us on social media at BeatSeekerPod. Beat Seeker is recorded in the Devil Lake Studios and the Tunnel Under Arundel. The show is produced by Matt McButter, Mike Wider, and Kate McCartney. Thanks for tuning in, and keep seeking.